Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from The Bugle.
Welcome to Tiny Revolutions with me, Tiff Stevenson, where we talk to comedians, performers, activists and various people about their tiny revolutions, the art and political movements that have made a difference to them. I'm joined today by the fantastic W. Kamau Bell and Nato Green, all the way from the United States, and I'm going to applaud them on.
Yay.
The sound of one person clapping.
That's about how I did at the Edinburgh Festival, so that works.
Hi guys, welcome to the show. I'm going to start at the start. Basically, everyone I've invited onto this show is a tiny revolution to me. So, you know, I'm aware of both of your work. We've done festivals together. I love your stuff. And I want to talk about you working together. But before we get into that, I'd like to know, let's start at the beginning. How did you become comedians, specifically political comedians? Was this by design or happy accident?
I became a political comedian at about the same time that I became a comedian. Because when I was a kid, my grandfather every week would clip out political cartoons from the newspaper and mail them to me from his house in Chicago. And then we would get on the phone every week and discuss the political cartoons. So from an early age, I have no memory of being aware of politics without being aware of joking about politics. And that started when I was probably in sixth grade. So when I started doing stand-up, which is now 16 years ago, I had the good fortune of, like, I, you know, started doing comedy and did what everybody did and wrote jokes about dicks and whatever. And then, a month into me doing stand-up, Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, and I was very upset about it and about how that disaster was unfolding in the Bush administration response, and then wrote about that. And that was the first time I got laughs, and I was like, oh, this is what I do. And it's not, I became a political comedian because I'm a political person. In addition to being a comedian, I've been a union organizer for over 20 years. And so am involved. So being sort of being connected to the left and activists in different social movements and being involved in organizing myself, sort of like, I feel like I'm someone who comments on politics as a comedian, as a participant, rather than as an observer.
So life made you political by the sounds of it in your comedy. If it's Hurricane Katrina, a big event that comes along and says, I can't not talk about this because this affects all of us.
The system created me, man.
Okay, Kamau, what about you?
I mean, so as I've joked about a lot, I grew up in one of those households where every month was Black History Month. So as a Afro-American, after it was the 70s. So, you know, there were always conversations in my house about race. At the time, I didn't know that stuff was political. So it was just the way that my mom talked. you know, as my favorite joke from my young era of stand-up comedy was I was 8 years old before I realized that a cracker was also a delicious snack.
Salty.
So, yes. So, yeah, so I was always in my life, but I wanted to be a comedian because of Eddie Murphy on Saturday Night Live. There was nothing about it that was like in the tradition of Dick Gregory. There was nothing about that in what I wanted to do. And but then after becoming a comedian, after failing for a long time, after struggling to find my voice, a man ran for president named Barack Hussein Obama, and I became very interested in him because I grew up in a house talking about racism. And then at some point, I started getting booked on political comedy shows because I was talking about the black guy running for president. And it's around that time that I think NATO sort of identified me as a political comedian. It's like, come do these shows with me. They're better political comedy shows than the ones you're currently getting booked on. So, yeah, it was definitely an evolution.
So, again, it seems like an external thing sort of pushed you forward in that direction as opposed to you deciding you're a political comedian. The world told you, hey, you're a political comedian.
Yeah, I was just like, I'm going to do this. And then people said, that's political comedy. But then the thing that happened was, as I was saying earlier, I would get booked on political comedy shows. And this happened in NATO, too. And they'd be like, that's not what we mean by political comedy. So,
right, okay.
You're talking about racism too much.
Right, so I saw this early in the show that you did together. And we will come back to it in the work section. But on Laughter Against the Machine, yourself and NATO are having a conversation about the fact that a lot of what's deemed political comedy in America is where they want liberal comedians to turn up and reaffirm their opinions, mm-hmm. rather than actually joke about, you know, all of the stuff around it.
Yeah.
So the liberal audiences expect their opinions to be reinforced. Have I got that correct?
You have got that correct. I mean, even with Joe Biden being president right now, and I'm sure NATO's running into this, if you criticize Joe Biden, you're like, hey, he just started. Give him a chance. Like, you know, I can't make jokes. Like, when does the jokes time of start with Joe Biden?
You know, when Kamau and I started doing political comedy shows together was when, you know, sort of towards the end of the George Bush administration, and there was like, prior to that point, I think now people don't remember what political comedy was like at that point, but it was like very much like a sort of twee kind of white guy vibe. There were these things that were like on, you know, on public television, and it felt like you would sort of, you know, it was quippy and clever, and it felt like there was a disconnect between what people understand as political comedy and what we were interested in, which was the comedy of social criticism that encompassed racism and, you know, other types of oppression that people who were activists would identify with. And so, you know, we really wanted to push the idea of that political comedy should indict all of us because the whole system is f***ed up. Like recently, you know, the Facebook memories reminded me that the day that Obama was elected president, I got a call from a reporter for the local newspaper, the Big Daily in San Francisco, saying, you know, how are you going to make jokes about politics anymore now that Obama's president? And I, like, day one of Obama being president, I was like, yeah, but still, f*** this country. I'm not finished.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's what brilliant comedy is, and that's the thing that both of you do. You should be hitting social, sort of, you know, socio, personal, economic, political, that they all kind of, you know, because the personal is political as well in lots of ways. And Kamau, did you come through San Francisco as well then? Was that obviously where the two of you met doing comedy?
Yeah, I moved to San Francisco from Chicago. I'd started doing comedy in Chicago. And at some point, it was like being in school where I realized like I repeated the same year three times, my first 3 years of comedy. And so I knew San Francisco had a great reputation, and I moved there and, you know, still sort of like noodled along. And then by the time I met NATO, I was just starting to be like, you know, I'm 10 years in. I think I finally maybe have figured out stand-up comedy. So, yeah, that was what happened.
And both of you coming through San Francisco as a scene, you were kind of talking about, I think, again, in an episode of Laughter Against the Machine, that you were sort of bringing this kind of hipster politics from San Francisco, sometimes preaching to the converted. it's interesting that you're both so political, because San Francisco is in lots of ways this kind of idyllic, very right on place, but also the inequality is so vast. I mean, possibly more so than anywhere else I've been in America, that I can really see the divide in terms of wealth and poverty. And I wanted to ask class, because class is such a huge thing in the UK. Does it play out the same way in America? Like, firstly, how would you define yourself in terms of class, or does it even exist in the same way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Nato, you can speak to this. You're a union organizer, but I don't think we think about it the same way that people think about it in the UK, because we have this racism thing that gets us all hung up. So we certainly, there's talk of class, but not in a sense of like the identify your station. I don't think. I think there's really like 1%ers and everybody else, I think, is how we sort of think about it. But what do you think, Nato?
Yeah, I think you're right. Like the UK has an awareness about class that people don't like in the US. People think that class is the same as income, and that that sort of have a hard time recognizing that like it's more than just what's in your checkbook. That, you know, there are some circumstances where, like, no matter how much money you make, you're not going to get let in the right clubs. And Kamau's right. Like, in class and race are in constant communion in the United States. Partly to like answer your question, I am like your textbook, like, middle class Jewish intellectual. You know what I mean? I'm the first person, like, in my family in four generations not to go to graduate school.
Right.
You know, because capitalism is failing and we're all downwardly mobile now. and there's no future. So it's just that, you know. And when I became a union organizer, my grandmother was like, can't you be a labor lawyer or a labor historian or, you know, something more prestigious than the guy, like, literally holding the picket signs, you know. And you're right, like, San Francisco has this sort of like somewhat, you know, historically, you know, hip sort of like tolerant culture, but with both inequality and also racism. We have some, you know, as Kamau has talked about, in his shows, like San Francisco has some pretty special kinds of racism. If you're tasting racism from around the world, and the economic inequality, like, there was some like World Bank study that San Francisco has a level of economic inequality that is somewhere between Guatemala and Rwanda.
Wow.
It's a stat to be proud of.
That's a big, big divide, or a big poverty gap. Is that what they call it? Which does sound like, you know, a year out to go and work in the shop.
Yeah, right.
For a lot of people in the UK, it's much more linked to, I guess, to school and opportunity. And America has, I guess, a slightly more broader idea that anyone from anywhere could become president, and sometimes does. Mm-hmm. Right, that where you went to school shouldn't be as important. In the UK, class is very much linked to, like you say, the clubs you can get into, the schools you could go to, who you know, who might be giving you those opportunities, as well as wealth and generationally, you know, what your family did. So what about you, Kamau?
Yeah, I would say here, all of that is linked to race. Like, right. All of that is like that all of that is like what clubs you can get into, what schools you can get into, what level of society you can get into, what level of corporate America you can get into is way more linked to race than linked to class. Like, I mean, or linked to some sort of idea of like, well, if you're born a poor white person, you can earn yourself into it, and you somehow hit some sort of tranche of money, you can then get into all those places, all the right places, once the money. But as a black person, there's been, you know, any number of rich black people tell you, like, I went here and found out that my money was no good and not in a good way, you know? So, and I say that as somebody who, you know, I definitely earn more money than Nato Green. I am definitely more wealthy than Nato Green. I've never said it out loud. It feels good. But I could still walk outside of this hotel right now and get killed by a cop just because I'm a black guy in America.
Right.
I should switch those punchlines up. That in part's not as funny.
It's our two-person reparations.
Yes.
One other thing I was going to say about class is that the U.S. class system is not especially Like, there's not that much mobility. There's just enough mobility to maintain the illusion of mobility. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
they let just a few people through, and it's always contingent. So, like, for me, you know, a lot of the clubs and the access to the circles of, you know, elite power as a Jew, I don't have access to, because Jews aren't, like, don't count as white people unless we go full fucking Jared Kushner and completely embrace white supremacy, and then we get let in.
Yeah. But how could you live with yourself, NATO?
Right. And then you have to be that guy.
Following on from that, what are your earliest political memories? Because I know both of you are saying you sort of had conversations in the House. Like, one of my, I will share with you my earliest sort of memory of anything happening politically in terms of a movement was with Margaret Thatcher and milk. So basically I went into school and we used to have milk every day at break time, and then she took it away. So it was there one day, then it was gone, and she was called Thatcher, Milk Snatcher. That was like the refrain. My mum was very anti-Margaret Thatcher. My parents vote differently. They're on the opposite sides of, you know, politically. But that being my first, and I didn't know at the time it was political. I just knew that there was a thing and then there wasn't a thing. So what's your sort of earliest memories of that political moment?
I mean, I remember growing up knowing that I wasn't supposed to like Ronald Reagan, and I really don't know that I knew exactly why, but I remember very viscerally knowing, like, we don't like that guy. Like, we don't like that. We don't f*** with him. Like, I remember very viscerally. And then I remember, I mean, the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. So I think really knowing that the president was not somebody who was your friend necessarily was a thing that I knew very early on, that was a thing that could exist. So, yeah, I think that even though... And I'll say this, even though there were other things that I would now look back on as political conversations, but they were tied to race, and at that point I didn't understand them to be political. And I don't even know that the people who I heard them from understood them to be political.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. What about you, NATO?
So my parents were active in the left, and so I grew up going to anti-nuclear rallies and U.S. out of El Salvador rallies and things like that. The earliest memory that I can pin a date to is the assassination of Harvey Milk. So for the international listeners, Harvey Milk was a elected member of the San Francisco city government, and he was the first out gay politician elected to public office in the United States. And he was elected in 77, I think, and he was assassinated in 78 by a former colleague. And there were riots in San Francisco. And so that's sort of my earliest memory of that there was a gay civil rights leader who was murdered, and people took to the streets over it. And my parents were really upset.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What were the kind of films, TV shows, and stuff like that that were influencing sort of what's now become your comedic oeuvre for both of you? What were your sort of early influences?
I mean, for me, like I always say, I was a comedy nerd before that was a thing that we knew existed. Like I'm at the age where like I remember seeing like stand-up comedy go from this thing that was only on albums to this thing that was like everywhere and basic cable and every late night talk show had a stand-up comic. And, you know, I remember seeing Jerry Seinfeld on his first, on like, I don't know if his first, but on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Eddie Murphy. I remember seeing Eddie Murphy on Saturday Night Live go from that black guy in the back who didn't get a lot of lines to like hosting the show while he was on the show and really feeling invested in his success. It is quite depressing for me to think that I've had a long career in comedy and did not end up in the sequel to Coming to America.
I just watched it the other day. Yes.
I haven't watched it yet. It's too painful. I just would have, if you told me I had it, yeah, you're going to be a stand-up comic when you grow up, and then the sequel to Coming to America is going to come out. I'd be like, oh, well, I'll totally be in it. No, there was no, I didn't.
You could be in the third one.
The third one, he's not in.
The all Jermaine Fowler one.
Yeah, the one that Eddie's not in anymore. I'll be in that one.
Coming to America 3, Tokyo Drift or something, whatever. Yeah, it'll be.
Coming 3, America. So, yeah, so I was just a fan of comedy, like a fan of like Saturday Night Live and everything. As a fan, you know, at the time that every other black kid in America was talking about hip hop, I was talking about the Young Comedian special on HBO. that was my thing.
But you saw yourself represented then, because there's a beautiful bit in your special that's on Netflix where you talk about your daughter watching a TV show about doctors. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I don't want to repeat the bit because I'll do it a disservice, but it's a really beautiful bit about representation, really, and her kind of having a moment of going, black women are doctors. Mm-hmm. And that's what I see and that's what I expect. So did you feel like you were kind of represented by seeing Eddie Murphy on screen?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think when I think about seeing Eddie Murphy on SNL, I mean, I was eight. I don't know. But I felt like he was like 19. And I felt like, oh, we're basically the same age. You know what I mean? Like, I felt like, because he was so much younger than everybody else in that cast. And also just looked like a regular black dude at that point. He does not look like a regular black dude anymore. But I think that my mom always said that when she was coming up, she would go to anything a black person was in just because you were like excited to see a black person on screen, whether it was TV or movies. Whereas my generation, that wasn't really possible in the same way anymore. But therefore, it meant like I could see versions of myself in show business. So it was something I could imagine, and way more than I could imagine being a doctor.
Right. And NATO, for you, there's hardly any Jewish comedians. So I imagine that must have been tough.
When are we going to catch a break, the Jewish guys? You know, I was also a comedy nerd before that was a thing. And like, I mean, I remember there was a time I was able to go to the video store and rent every single stand-up comedy video that they had at the video store and watch all of them. That was a thing that was possible to do. Could go to Blockbuster Video, just work your way through the stand-up special section.
And now you won't even watch your friends' comedy specials, right?
Yeah, people... I watched your special, man.
I'm not talking about me. I'm just saying, it gets to the point where your friend goes, my new special's out. And you're like, I'll tweet about it, but I don't know if I'm going to sit through it.
Yeah. Yeah, your friends put out a special and you're like, I know what the f*** you have to say. Yeah,
exactly.
So in terms of comedy, like, you know, also growing up in the Bay Area, I mean, I have a very vivid memory of, you know, Robin Williams really spoke to me. And when Robin Williams hosted Saturday Night Live, there was one when it was Robin Williams and Paul Simon, when Graceland came out. And like staying up to watch that Saturday Night Live, you know, there was a point, I mean, actually speaking of Jewish comics, in I want to say 88 or 89, Jackie Mason had this Carnegie Hall special that was on HBO, and every single member of my family had it on VHS or cassette, and it was in their car all the time or on at their house all the time. And just seeing like how intensely my entire family reacted to that special and identified with every single joke. But like you couldn't, you know, anytime one of my relatives would be like, would go to a restaurant and then ask for something that wasn't on the menu or some different thing, everyone would be like, that's like that Jackie Mason bit. And then growing up in San Francisco during the comedy boom, like when I was in high school, and, you know, I started hanging out at comedy clubs in middle school because my middle school science teacher's roommate was the doorman at the club, one of the first clubs that Kamau worked at. So my middle school science teacher, like, comedy was, you know, at the time, San Francisco had this thing, Comedy Day in the Park, that drew 50,000 people to the park every year. There was a local stand-up showcase on local television. There was a local stand-up radio show on morning radio. And there were 5 full-time comedy clubs in the city. So there was just like a ton of stand-up around. And I was into it. And my science teacher was like, oh, I'll take you to the club. And so then I just started going to the club, like, every week. And I would go on Tuesday night because that's when the owner of the club wasn't there and the comedians would do weird shit. and so started hanging around watching and got to see like all of these, you know, people come up through the San Francisco, you know, club system, and seeing like, you know, just seeing people. What really sort of connected for me was seeing people sort of go from being like a strong comic to sort of who the person that we know them as today. You know what I mean? Like I got to, you know, watch Margaret Cho go from being an MC to a headliner, and, you know, and seeing people like come into their voice as a comedian was really exciting to me.
For both of you then, was this seen as a viable thing to do as a career? Because I think in the UK, that's one of the things, if you're a working class person, you're not really told that you're sort of told a little bit the arts aren't for you, or this isn't a career option. Al Madrigal said that he had a career counsellor at school that just did comedy. There was a door marked comedy because a comedian had gone to his school. And that just sort of blew my mind a bit, that in America, people are like, oh yeah, people have careers doing this. Did you feel that? Or was there any resistance to either of you entering it as a career from your family's perspective or anything else?
I mean, I do think in America, there is a myth of our own exceptionalism. I don't know if you've heard about that, that we can do whatever we want to do. And so I think that like that exists throughout America, that you can sort of like, certainly there are different families who preach different things, but I do think there is more access to dreaming in that sense, because you're told you can, even though, as Nato said earlier, it's a lie. Most of us don't have access to do whatever we want to do. But so I think for me specifically, because my mom had sent me to really good schools, I kind of knew that I was not going to, that I was going to be able to, if this comedy thing didn't work out, I was going to be able to, I wasn't going to end up like in the gutter. Like I would be like, I'll figure something out. You know, I had this, I'll figure something out. On top of that, I think I also was very deluded, is that the word?
Yeah.
About how easy it was going to be to be a stand-up comedian.
All of us.
So I think, yeah. So I think that, I think it was like, I knew I'd figure something out. Also, I was like, well, I'll start in 3 years. I'll probably move to LA, get one of those sitcom things. And I mean, I was very serious about that. Like, I was like, oh, you know, you move to LA, get a sitcom thing, do that. Then I'll be in the next Lethal Weapon movie and get a book deal. And, you know, I'll just be an international touring comedian. You know, so I think I was, it. I think the thing that I learned over time is that I really had to do it because comedy kept sort of giving me reasons to quit, and I never quit. So I think at some point you become, this is just who I am. It's some sort of calling, and I have to see it through.
Yeah, I did. I think if any of us knew how long it would take to get good and find our voices, I wonder if like we'd actually do it. Like, because I do think it's, I think you seek, because, you know, brilliant comics make it look so easy on stage. Everyone, like both of you do, you know, I hope I do, that people watch that and go, oh, well, that's easy, because they appear to be just chatting and they're really mm-hmm. funny. But the skill it takes to get to that point and to have that moment, like you're saying, Nato, of where you see someone become the comic they're becoming, takes a lot of graft, a lot of hard work.
Every single time before I perform, right before I walk out on stage, I say to myself or whoever's next to me, maybe tonight is the night I quit comedy.
Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the fact that we all know that if we wanted to, we could quit. But not that we could, but the option is there to stop, because you just stop, but we never will.
I mean, I think I have quit, actually. If I look at the number of hours I spent as a stand-up comic in the last 3 years, you know, even before the pandemic, I was doing less and less stand-up comedy. Like, so every now and again, I go, am I the person who retired and didn't know it? Like, am I the last to know that I retired?
It's not the first time you retired, Kamau.
I know. But this time I was like, normally I knew I was retiring.
I've seen you walk off stages you didn't like before.
Oh, yes. I was a famous walker offer. Yes. Oh, I miss those days of just like in the middle of a set, I'm done here.
Really? Were you that? I only have one friend who I think was a walker offer in the UK, comic called Benny Boot. And even if he was like storming, he would just have this moment where he in his head perceived that he was tanking, and then he would just like self-implode and then leave. I've never seen anything like it. I was like, you're being so funny, I don't know what's happening.
I was like that, except for the if I was storming part. If I was killing, I would stay. But if it was not going to my satisfaction, I'm America's Benny Boot, as they say.
I've also seen Kamau like finish, like, not walk off mid-set, but finish the set and, like, be home in bed before anyone has had a chance to say goodbye to him. People would be like, did he have a trap door or something? Where did he go?
Yes. Time to go.
I at some point figured out that I feel like I have wondered whether the pandemic has told me that I've quit comedy against my will. Several years ago, this thing happened where I wasn't on stage for several weeks, and then I was at visiting with family in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, outside of Boston, and I felt like I was losing my mind, and I was like, I have to find a microphone. And I went online and found a Best of Boston showcase in the basement of a DoubleTree hotel in Hyannis, ooh, Massachusetts.
That ooh, already in the basement of a hotel is always.
And I drove 45 minutes and talked, oof, to the producer, and he was like, "I don't usually like liberals, but you seem okay." And then you could do 8 minutes, and then I went up and did 8 minutes, and I did the job, and it was fine, and it felt so good, and I feel like I just made peace with the fact that I'm going to be a person who does this thing whether or not I end up making a living at it, and I'm a guy who talks to the microphone and also have a rewarding career as a union organizer, and make some, I wage class struggle. So, and I enjoy that. It became clear to me that show business was not looking for the people who write checks in Hollywood don't think that the next comedian they need to get behind is a mid-40s left-wing Jewish intellectual dad from San Francisco.
They're wrong, NATO.
who, as Kamau is saying, isn't that flexible and isn't willing to play the game and isn't going to hang out. And, nobody's like,
if he does hang out, he's going to say something that they're not going to like.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I applied for something and there was a question about how do you promote diversity, in your work? And I was like, well, I'm committed to toppling all forms of domination. And they were like, that's not what we meant. So, I just think that I'm going to be outside of that world and look for ways to be creatively satisfied.
What made you decide to come together and go, we're going to take a political show on the road and we're going to film it?
Lack of job opportunities, I think, was a big part of it. like realizing that there wasn't a home for what we did. So it's like you have to build it yourself. I think that I remember we were in the it was a nightclub that used to do nights of comedy occasionally. And it was a room I hated doing. And one night we were in there and we sort of hatched out what we would do if we could do the show ourselves, if we had our own show. Because I'm a big believer that you need to, as you say in the UK, do what it says on the tin. So if you name it something that is what it is, then the people who come through know what it is, and if they don't, it's on them. So when we came up with the name Laughter Against the Machine, I was like, there's no way you don't get that, and if you don't get it, then it's on you. So I think obviously an allusion to the rock band Rage Against the Machine,
yes,
who we're both fans of. And so it just felt like if we say that, then you get that the political comedy is going to be a little more pointed than what you would expect from somebody who's like, what are these idiots in Congress doing? So I think that was the idea of and then I think when we started doing it, the shows were fun. We did get an audience who wasn't a comedy club audience generally. They were people who were like, I like this idea of this and I will come see you guys. And we weren't doing it in comedy clubs mostly. And then we decided to, this is the early days of Kickstarter. So it was just a thing that everybody was doing. So let's go around the country and film it and turn it into a documentary. And 14 years later, you can watch it for free in pieces on Means TV.
When Bush was president, there was this boom in political comedy shows, like a bunch of people, kids, there was a simpler time when people thought that George W. Bush was the worst president ever that America could have.
Before he was allowed to come out of Texas and walk around I'm not so bad anymore, right guys?
I'm a painter now. And so there were all these people doing these liberal comedy tours, progressive comedy tours kind of stuff during the Bush years. And then when Obama got elected, everyone was like, okay, we're done. And Kamau and I weren't done. And so we started doing these shows in the Bay Area and then going to other places that were where we thought people would be into us. Like, we went to Seattle and had a good time. And then there was a congresswoman named Gabby Giffords who got shot in Arizona. There was this hate crime shooting. And we had this conversation of like, man, there's got to be some cool people. Arizona, she gets shot. Sheriff Joe or Arpaio is doing these like horrible, like war crimes, like human rights abuses in the county jail there. You know, they're passing laws to criminalize immigrants. And we're like, Arizona seems like it sucks. There's got to be some cool people there who could use a laugh. And then we're like, well, let's go figure out how to bring laughs to them. And then booked a tour on that basis without realizing that we, at that point, had no following in those places. And no one knew who we were. And we had to figure out how to get people to come to the shows. But it was a good idea anyway.
So how did you do that? Did you just go out and meet people at marches and,
Yes.
Yes, we did that. And it was the early days of the internet being a place where you could sort of, we're talking about the early days of Facebook and all those things. So we were definitely using that and also connecting with people. A lot of it happened connecting through organizations on the ground. They're going, hey, invite your people from your organization to our show. I know you don't think you like stand-up comedy, but and you have a lot of good evidence that says you don't like stand-up comedy, but invite your people to our show, and then sort of trying to spread the word that way. And then as it shows in the series, and then it happened at the same time that Occupy Wall Street took off. So then there was just more talk in general about inequality, and the first time that the news said things like economic inequality and wealth disparity. And so we sort of were happening at the right time where people were out looking for things to sort of like do to support this thing that they were now learning about.
And this is during the Obama administration, right?
I know, yeah.
So it kind of seems wild now when we know how bad it can get, like you were saying, NATO.
We're still finding out how bad it can get. We're still investigating here if we can make how bad it can get.
We haven't hit bottom.
No.
My rule of thumb is, like, one of the key principles for me is that you need to hang out with people from El Salvador. Because, when people in the United States are like, oh, this is, Trump is fascist, the right wing is fascist, things are about to get dangerous. People in El Salvador have, fought death squads for 100 years. So generally, I just check in with my Salvadoran friends. Like, it's not, you don't need to worry until the Salvadorans get worried.
Do you now plan to come back together and do this again? Do you feel like with this time, 14 years on, like you were saying, do you feel like you could do this tour again now? What do you think of the political landscape now? Do you feel you could do it? Do you feel it's important? Because I think right now, not preaching to the choir is such a huge thing, and trying to, I guess, you call it reaching across the aisle, don't you, in America, or like trying to appeal to people who might be wavering on certain issues, not just necessarily the people that you would. I think now would be a brilliant time. Is that something you would consider or do?
First of all, I have to wait till my COVID vaccine fully kicks in before I start going to small, dark rooms with strangers. I think that's a thing that as I see comedians going on the road now or comedy shows opening back up, I'm like, I'm not there yet. So I think that we are always having these conversations in the work that we do. I think if we were to do it again, it'd be because we wanted to do it. I think the marketplace has really shifted. Trevor Noah is the host of The Daily Show now in America. Back when Jon Stewart was the host, he was basically the only person doing that work. And now we have, literally that work is being done, as we said earlier, on TikTok. There are people who are like, you'll see a 30-second video of like, let me explain to you why this thing is wrong. So I think that there's a lot more critique out there, which is great. And I think the work that I'll speak for myself, I'm doing that Laughter Against the Machine work, in other spaces. CNN is not preaching to the converted as much as people think CNN is a liberal network. So I feel like I'm with my show United States of America, every season I'm like pulling that audience further and further to the left. So but I think that, anything could happen, but I don't think we're hatching, unless NATO tells me we're hatching our plans, I don't think we're hatching our plans.
I don't think of the project as reaching across the aisle. Like, the people on the other side of the aisle are not what I'm concerned about. The people that I'm concerned about are the people that Kamau was talking about earlier, the people who were like, why are you being so hard on Biden already? The people who were like, the people who were mad about Trump putting kids in cages, but are less mad about Biden putting kids in cages.
Right.
Or the people who are, even though, you know, we've been accused of preaching to the converted, the project is always to challenge. And it's like anybody can make fun of the other guy. And because, you know, I think a core value for me in my comedy, and I think Kamau shares this, is like, if you look at the world, none of us are innocent.
Yeah.
None of us are off the hook. And so because we're all responsible, it's our job to implicate ourselves in our comedy. And it's the easiest thing in the world to go on stage and be like, look at those idiots over there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, if they're that dumb, why are they ruining the world? Like, and we're so smart. And so, you know, and so so sometimes the fissures come in ways that are unexpected. Like in San Francisco, because of the inequality in San Francisco, you know, I've done a lot of material about, you know, the destruction that the tech industry and tech money has delivered on this city. And then I have tech people coming up to me after the show, like having a, you know, private moral reckoning with themselves. They're liberals, they're Democrats, they're pro, you know, they might have even voted for Bernie Sanders, but then they're like wrestling with their own, you know, complicity in the system. You know, we once, you know, we did a show and it was during one of the many times that Israel was like bulldozing people's houses in the West Bank. And I did jokes about that. And I could feel like a whole section of the room being about to walk out. You know, again, they're all liberals, they're all Democrats, but you know, sometimes everybody has a line where, and you know, it's our job to figure out where that, you know, what those tender spots are and prod them.
And it might be at that same show where the thing that got the audience the maddest at me is when I made fun of Tyler Perry.
I was about to bring that up.
And I was like, all the things that have been said on the stage tonight, and this guy heckled me because he didn't like the fact I was talking shit about Tyler Perry.
I'm always fascinated by what people's sacred cows are. You know, like, mm-hmm. I've talked about abortion on stage and gun control. And one night at a club, I did jokes about the royal family, about the Queen, and a woman got up and walked out. And I was like, wow. Like, to be that sensitive or that defensive of an incredibly rich family who you're told are better than you by birth, like, I find insane. But I agree with you in terms of, like, self-examination. I think that's a huge part of what helps going forward, because I think we're in a culture now where we all want to be on the right side of history, is how I describe it. We all want to be on the right side of history, but throwing other people under the bus doesn't mean you automatically get to get on it. So, like, if you can check your own shit or within your own kind of thing, like, before you point over there and go, look how they're getting it wrong, that we maybe come to ourselves first and look at, like, how we process and deal and view things, that then that should always be the place we start. Because I do think there's a danger with political comedy that people feel like they're being told off, and people don't want to feel like, even obviously no one here is sort of guilty of this. I hope that I'm not. I might have sometimes when I haven't felt the way to make it funny enough, but I don't want to feel like I'm telling someone off, because I feel that people sort of shut down mm-hmm. when they're being told that they're wrong.
Yeah, there's a thing on my podcast, we had Adrienne Marie Brown on, and the idea, and she spoke to this, and other people spoke to this, the idea of calling in versus calling out. Like, you know, if you're calling somebody out, it's really about your own performative, like, you're wrong, and I know you're wrong, and I'm better than you because I can say that you're wrong, as opposed to going, hey, I don't think that's correct, come here, let me talk to you about it. And I think that for the most part, you know, I feel like this, like, if I want, I'm pretty clear about who I want on my side and who I feel like is lost. And I will call out the people who I feel like are lost when I want to call them out. You know, I'll go on a Dr. Drew rant with the best of them and feel like I don't have any need for you anymore. But if it's somebody who I feel like is like, you're just headed in the wrong, I think you could be headed in a better direction, then the approach is different. So, and I think the one thing we just learned, this is the frustrating part about Biden. The only reason we got Trump out of office is because a bunch of people came together who were like, Biden's not my guy, but Trump's really not my guy. So I'm going to do a lot of work to get Biden in, based on the idea that once he gets in, he's going to understand that I did this work. And by I, I'm referring to black women. And now those black women are like, I have the receipts of the work I did, President Biden. Can we get him to look at those receipts? So I think that, like, that's what... It's very clear that, like, a lot of people decided to, instead of calling out, they called in a bunch of people, go, okay, we need to do this right now because it's for the greater good. But now do we get what we need now that we've done that, is the question.
Right. That's a really lovely way of describing it, calling in rather than calling out.
You know, sometimes comics will, you know, when comics want to complain about political correctness, or comics want to say that, like, you know, left-wing audiences can't take a joke or feminist audience can't take a joke. And I always feel like, I don't know, I mean, lots of people can't take a joke if you make fun of the shit that they care about in a lame way. Like, you know, sports fans can't take a joke either if you make fun of their team. So, you know, I think what people are willing to let you make fun of their stuff if they can, you know, it's the same. I mean, it's in that way, like, the politics are similar to, you know, to a lot of the other stuff around identity. Like, I can make fun of Jews in a way that, you know, Kamau's not going to make fun of Jews publicly. So, you know, but if you can demonstrate to people in how you present your material that you're making fun of it as a participant and a member of the group, and, like, we can laugh at ourselves, can't we? As opposed to someone who's an outsider who doesn't care and is ridiculing them in a superficial way, I think people are ready to hear it and ready to laugh at themselves.
Well, that's self-deprecating as well, because you are intrinsically then part of the joke as well. It's the difference between me making a joke about my boobs on stage, which I've only done recently because it was such a huge thing. And, you know, like, but me making jokes about them and talking about getting athlete's foot tit versus someone bringing me on stage and kind of going, this next act has a massive rack, which has happened before. Like, you know, I've been introduced.
Of course it has. I don't know why I'm feigning surprise. Of course it has. Oh my God, I can't imagine. Yeah, of course it has.
And people not understanding that objectifying is different to owning jokes about yourself and your own experience and stuff. So, yeah, so I that kind of lands with me in a very, in a very specific way.
Years ago, when I was still, before I got richer than NATO, I was opening for a comedian. And who's now a very famous comedian, and so he'll remain nameless just because I don't feel the need to name him. But and I had a joke where I used the N word. You know, it's part of the joke. And then this guy, white guy from the South, got on stage and said, "Give it up for Kamau. He's one funny nigger." And the audience went, "What? Nope."
Yes, it's not okay for you to say, "Oh my God,
yeah,
I knew that's where you were going," but still, it made me feel so tense.
Yeah. And I mean, and I remember I was, like, not even fully off the, like, I was off stage, but, like, the lights were still sort of on me. So it was, and I really turned around like, is that what we're doing? And again, this, I feel like sometimes comics do that to each other, but the audience doesn't know they're in on the joke. And I was like, dude, I haven't even had a conversation with you yet.
Yes. Yeah, if you'd have been backstage going, "Would it be funny if I," and you'd have been like, "No, it won't be."
You could have
cleared that up straight away. And here's the thing. I like that you said that you didn't want to name the person, because this happened with the boob thing with me. I think I posted, it was a couple of years ago, and I posted about it on social media, and people were like, name and shame, name. And I was like, I don't want to, because I believe in people making mistakes and being able to apologize for those mistakes, but I just wanted to let you know. I wanted to use it as an example so that other male comics could see it and go, this isn't cool. It's not the first time it's happened, and the person who did it apologized afterwards, and, you know, we sort of moved on from there. But, like, also I can choose to talk about it in whatever way I want to talk about it. I don't like this pressure or this idea that we have to instantly just go, this is who it is. And, you know, then it makes it this, like, kind of huge thing where they're on either side. And then you've got people steaming in to defend this guy.
Yeah. That's one reason not to name it. It's because, like, I don't want to spend my next week talking about this and have the, like, and this become, like, I don't want to spend the next week where this becomes my part-time job, is dealing with having to deal with people who have feelings about who I named. And also that thing that happened to you, he ain't the first person to do that or something like that. It's about the structure. I think right now in America, we're trying to really get people focused on talking about the structures of white supremacy, not just the Ku Klux Klan and the neo-Nazis. And that's about the structure of misogyny. Like, it's not, so he wasn't like he stepped out of some box, goes, I just came with an idea. what if I'm shitty to a woman on stage?
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing that is happening, and you're giving an example of it, but to name him is to act like he's the only one who ever did it.
Exactly. And put the weight of, yes, put the weight of all the people who've done it. And there's been people who've done it worse.
Yes.
You know, and I haven't named them. And also, I it's someone that I sort of like. So I was able to kind of take them aside and go, hey, you know, and also sometimes on stage, people say stuff. It's a live situation. I'm sort of forgiving of, if they were a repeat offender, that's a different thing. But I think sometimes people do things that seems like a great idea at the time. And I think I was maybe hosting the night, because I think it was at my gig, which was also why it was a bigger thing, because I'd invited some younger female comics to come into the room. And I've had rooms that are always just, you know, this room is a great room. People want to play it. People want to come into this room. And, you know, this is a young girl who's entering into the business, and I don't want it to be for her like it was for me when I came in. I want her to see that there are more women in power, and we've risen up, and we're there, and you can see us. And these aren't like going into a room 10 years ago where you're going to have someone kind of bring you on as a female impersonator, quote, end quote, which, you know, is not an insult to me, but obviously the person doing it thought it was, you know. So I didn't want her to think, God, this is what it's like.
Yeah.
So that, I was like, this is the moment to challenge. It's in my room. I'm hosting. I could come back up and challenge it on stage afterwards.
And with comedy, it's like, as we have grown as comedians, like, you know, I don't know about you, Tiff. I know that me and Kamau have said things in the past on stage that we today do not stand behind and are ashamed of.
Yes.
Because we were younger, we were inexperienced, we were scared, we didn't know what the f*** we were doing. I have tape of some of it.
Yeah.
I will hold it over Kamau forever. But so it's like, you don't want to say you're not accountable for it, but you want to recognize that it's a process of growth, and that people need to learn and go through it. And you need to, based on the relationship, you know, one time Kamau and I were at a comedy festival, and there was a white comic, super funny guy, and had like a pretty, you know, a huge bit, mostly white audience, that relied heavily on saying the N-word a lot. And like, it killed, but some of us pulled his sleeve after the show.
So we surrounded him. It was an intellectual bullying.
You know, and had a little intervention and just had the conversation of like, look, here's why, you know, and we're still friends with, you know, I'm still on good terms with that person.
Me too.
And think that he's a great comic, and that he was figuring something out in his development, and, you know, was trying this thing out. And it's not like he was going to be the, you know, branded as the, like, you know, that was his career plan. Was
he wasn't making bumper stickers and T-shirts for it.
Right. Just a thing that he was working on at the time. And then he got through it, and, you know, and we all, you know, and grew as a result of it. So
I think the thing about that, too, is that, and this is after you've been doing comedy for a while, you talk about and I've heard you talk about this, the phases of a comedian's life. I listened to the podcast you did with our friend Hari Kondabolu, and the idea that, like, at some point comedians go, oh, I'm going to be edgy. And they don't realize, do you understand that Lenny Bruce already did that and got arrested for it? So you can't be edgy enough that that's dropping the, and that's what I remember at the time being like, yeah, Lenny Bruce already did that. He already did the, I'm going to say the word. And he wrote it, and it was a better written joke because he's Lenny Bruce. So, like, you know, you can't, you know, so I think you letting people know that, like, you think you're doing something new, but you're not actually, you're just sort of walking in giant footsteps that we don't really deserve to walk in.
Yeah, and it's a process of learning. There's definitely stuff where I'm like, yeah, that wouldn't really, yeah. I feel like that was, even the other week, I'm doing a work in progress, and I wrote a joke about, I mean, even if I do it here, I don't know if it'll feel like, it's not the worst joke in the world. I said something about this, like, I wish that they would stop calling the Trump impeachment trial a stain on democracy, because Monica Lewinsky's dress called and said it wants its thing back.
Yeah.
But like, which I think is quite a funny joke. But then, you know, my other half pointed out to me, he was like, listen, you know, for the amount of shit Monica Lewinsky got, and I follow her on Twitter, and I met her once at a party, and I was like, would she think that was like on her? Because I wouldn't want to slut shame. I mean, I feel like in many ways we've moved on a lot, because she took so much of the blame for that when she wasn't the one who was in the relationship, you know, and that's a generational thing, and the power dynamics and everything that was in that. But Paul was like, well, you need to work on it and make it a bit clearer. And, you know, so that's a constant I feel like a constant like work in progress, that we should all be work in progress, right? Comedy is, and the only way to really find out is do it in front of an audience.
That's the scary thing about this particular era, because you have to sort of figure out where your own line is and where the audience line is. And some of that is from like, whoa, that joke was awful, I won't do that again. And unfortunately, we live in an era where if the wrong person writes that joke down and takes it to the internet or takes cell phone footage of it, then you become labeled as like, I thought she was a feminist. You know what I mean? And yeah. I think that's the scary part right now, is that I do think we have to leave room for comics to go too far while they're figuring out where the joke is and where the line is.
You got to walk over the line to know where the line is.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, on the conversation about comics trying to be edgy, it's like, literally this year, there are comics in India getting arrested because the government believes their act is indecent. So, like, none of us have ever risked arrest for our jokes. So, however edgy we might think we are, like, it's not, you know, in Iraq, there was a guy who was, like, tagged as the Iraqi Jon Stewart who was murdered. But, you know, like,
wow.
None of us are risking that much.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we're tiptoeing around some stuff where we're like, might not do that again, yeah. As opposed to, oh no, we've been put in prison for this.
Yeah. Boo-hoo, someone was mean on me on Twitter. Like, you know, okay.
Your own tiny revolutions is my final question to wrap this up. So anything that you found has been revolutionary in terms of breaking through with your work or your life, even, you know, whether that be meditation or getting up in the morning and doing a certain thing for an hour. So I just, what your individual tiny revolutions are.
This is going to sound like the thing that a person would say who had kids, but I'm going to say it because this is the, like truly at the end of the day, knowing that my kids are aware of the world and can have, especially my 6 and my 9 year old, the 2.5 year old, not so much, but like,
she's so dumb.
She's just, the pandemic has made her feral. It's not her fault. She's a wolf child now. But like, knowing that my kids, for example, know who George Floyd is, know what Black Lives Matter is, can specifically articulate why we don't like Donald Trump. In a way that I couldn't articulate about Ronald Reagan at the same point. Like, I was like, I just think we don't like him. We're just not with that dude. Knowing that my kids understand, seeing my kids get excited about representation. My 6-year-old is right now reading a book about Mae Jemison, the first black woman to go into space. First black woman astronaut. We didn't just put a black woman in space. She was an astronaut. She trained. But knowing that my kids have a real, like, solid awareness of the world and their identities in the world is super important to me in a way that like feels like I'm preparing them for the future, that I'm preparing, they're going to be more prepared for the future. So that's the thing, that's my tiny revolution. The rest of it is like, I'm glad that it happens, it feels good that it happens, but it all sort of points towards that.
Oh, that's great. That's a great answer. Thank you. NATO.
Yeah, I mean, I similarly, so one of my kids is a couple years ago started identifying as non-binary, and they're 12 and they're like in a whole different intellectual conversation about gender than anything that I understood. Like, there are things that are obvious to them that are like, you know, I mean, I did a joke about this in my stand-up, but things that like were, you know, that are like so obvious to them that would have taken our generation, you know, 4 years at university, like in a women's studies major to like get our heads around. And so listening to my kid make their way in the world and advocate for themselves and reckon with their own identity and talk about what they need, and organize the rest of us to affirm them and their humanity and to grow in the ways that we need to grow, and like, you know, in terms of, you know, and sending assigning reading to their grandparents and all that kind of stuff is really amazing.
So they've been revolutionary to you.
Yes.
Both of you are kids. That's lovely. I really like that answer. Thank you so much for coming on Tiny Revolutions. Do you have anything that you would like to plug?
So season 6 of my, well, I don't know if this, I don't know if it works in the UK, but my CNN show, United Shades of America, is coming back. Get a VPN that you can get it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Sneakily watch it. Get to see it, no matter how you do it.
Yeah.
We don't endorse it, but we endorse the show, how you get to it, nothing to do with us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Plausible deniability.
Yeah. What about you, NATO?
I'm at NATO Green on Twitter, Mr. NATO Green on Instagram. If you want some jokes and some incredibly detailed discussions of public policy and politics, and I have a couple albums out. If you want to support the arts, the best way to get the albums is Bandcamp. Otherwise, do whatever you have to do.
Thank you, W. Camel Bell and NATO Green, for giving us your tiny revolutions and coming on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can listen to other programs from The Bugle, including The Bugle, The Last Post, Tiny Revolutions, and The Gargle, wherever you find your podcasts.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.